Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning the programme looking forward to a big event next month. Not the US election, at least not this time. We will be looking at an incident that happened at a Donald Trump rally in 30 minutes. We're going to start, though, with the annual UN climate talks, COP29, as they're called. And we're doing so today because of another thunderous report from a UN agency which has just come out. It's from the World Meteorological Organization, and it's the unwelcome news of another record broken, that concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are building up faster than any time in human history. Dr. Oksana Tarasova is chief of the Atmospheric Environment Research Division at the WMO. What substances are we talking about?
The main greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, and let's be clear about it, is water vapor. But the water vapor has nothing to do with human activities. So we are talking in the bulletin with the greenhouse gases which are connected with human activities. The main one is carbon dioxide, CO2. The second one is methane. The third important one is nitrous oxide.
Have you worked out why it is these greenhouse gases are building up at a faster rate than ever before?
The reason for the greenhouse gases, and particularly we are talking about carbon dioxide, to build faster than before, is basically related to fossil fuel combustion. And we do a lot of fossil fuel combustion because we need to produce a lot of energy. Why it builds up in the atmosphere is because it stays in the atmosphere for about 1,000 years. So it's not like disappearing.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about just the sort of the locked-in damage in a moment. But are there other things as well? I mean, we know that our reliance on fossil fuels is something that is causing there to be greenhouse gas emissions. But are there other factors as well?
Absolutely. There are other factors, and we need to take a look at them. If we look at CO2 accumulation in the atmosphere, the terrestrial biosphere is taking up about 40% of human emissions. So it gives us like a substantial offset on the warming. And about 25% is taken up by the ocean. So actually what has an impact on climate and accumulates in the atmosphere is just less than 50% of what we really emit. And what happens is that when we have El Niño phenomena, which was happening at the end of last year, and that has caused an impact on the terrestrial biosphere. So basically on the offset. So it did have an impact on what happened within a year. And we do have a contribution from Canadian fires. We do have contribution from the bushfires in Australia later in the year. And we do have some contribution from the fires in Europe, in Greece in particular. And those emissions are pretty substantial, but you need to take them in the context of the whole big carbon cycle, the natural carbon cycle, because the fluxes from the biosphere, they are up and down. So biosphere is emitting through the respiration and taking up CO2 through the photosynthetic activity. So when you have El Niño, it's becoming hot in many parts of the world and dry. So the terrestrial biosphere starts taking less CO2 because it needs to preserve the water.
Right. So, I mean, I guess there is potentially some hope in the fact that, you know, El Niño is a cyclical phenomenon, so we've been through a bad patch. But I presume, I mean, given what you were saying about the importance of the forests and the oceans in terms of being a carbon sink, as those are degraded, then our ability to protect the atmosphere is only going to diminish.
What we see with our measurements is that the picture is pretty patchy. So it's not happening everything at the same time, but we see some signals that may be very worrisome. In particular, if you look at the big forest in Amazon, the Amazon Basin, that forest is in parts turning from being the sink of CO2, so from absorbing CO2, to being the source of CO2. The reason being a substantial deforestation. If you pass a certain percentage, it starts changing the local microclimate. The amount of precipitation is becoming less. And also what happens is that in a normal carbon cycle, you would expect the year one, you have everything burned, and then year two, it starts growing, and then you have an increasing uptake. The problem is that it will start growing in a different climate than the original forest. So when I speak to my colleagues in Amazon, they say that after the episodes of biomass burning, we have the recovery, but it's a different species which are growing there. And those new species may be not doing the same CO2 uptake as the original forest.
You've talked a lot about carbon dioxide. You did mention methane, but I guess methane is often overlooked as a greenhouse gas. It is, though, a lot more potent, isn't it, at least in the short term, than CO2, and a big product of natural gas, which, you know, a lot of people see as a sort of transition fuel away from coal and oil. How worried are you about the accumulation of methane emissions?
Well, unlike CO2, methane stays in the atmosphere for about 10 years. So if you actually start producing methane emissions, you will see the impact pretty fast. The bad thing is that you can exhaust your actions within 10 years. So we have to address methane in parallel with CO2 to actually gain more time in tackling the temperature increase. The interesting thing with methane is that you have a substantial number of sources which are natural. So let's say 60% of our methane is coming from anthropogenic sources and 40% is coming from natural. But there's a lot of things which are happening with methane, like these potential natural feedbacks which are related to increasing temperature and potential increase of methane from the biogenic sources, either natural or anthropogenic. And we do not understand completely why it starts rising or when it starts declining.
Oksana Tarasova from the World Meteorological Organization. It is perhaps one measure of how little optimism there is that the conflicts in the Middle East will wind down anytime soon, that the only new firm proposal that we've heard about is the one just put forward by Egypt, which is for an initial 2-day ceasefire in Gaza, involving the exchange of 4 Israeli hostages for a number of Palestinian prisoners and a greater delivery of aid. Anyway, it's something, and it is one of the ideas being discussed at new talks in Qatar today. All this comes as the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, prepares to debate bills which could transform how aid is delivered to the Palestinians, essentially by curbing the operations of UNRWA, the main UN relief agency. We'll get on to that in a moment. But first, with Yolande Nel, the BBC's Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, how significant are today's talks in Qatar?
Well, Israeli media are reading positive things into the fact that the Mossad chief who handles the negotiation file remains in Doha for now. He's there with the director of the CIA from the US. He's been talking to the Qatari prime minister. Of course, Qatar and Egypt are the important regional mediators. The Americans have presented the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar as having been the sort of chief obstacle to a deal, and have been saying that his killing by Israel this month represents an opportunity to get these talks restarted again. You can certainly see there's domestic pressure in Israel to return to meaningful ceasefire talks. Some hostage families have been demanding the government do more, and they took over a committee room in the parliament building at the start of the winter session earlier. I mean, it really remains to be seen what's possible given the intensity of the fighting that's still going on, particularly in the north of Gaza. And as yet, we've not had an official response from Israel or Hamas to that idea outlined by the Egyptian president last night, saying that it could move the situation forwards to have this very limited 2-day truce in exchange for 4 living Israeli hostages. Some have been saying in Israel that that idea could appeal because it could enable the clarification for Israelis of the decision-making process in Hamas now that Yahya Sinwar has been killed.
Right, and I guess that's part of the complication, isn't it? But Hamas are not, I mean, obviously they're not directly involved in any negotiations with the Israelis or the US, as far as we are aware. But there's no suggestion that they're being sort of lent upon by the Egyptians at this stage.
I mean, we do know that a Hamas delegation went to Cairo and met the Egyptian intelligence officials there last week. Israeli intelligence officials also passed through Cairo. Hamas are not taking part in the latest talks. They're kind of indirect talks that would take place with Israel, of course. But, of course, we do know as well that many Hamas leaders are based in Doha. It would be possible to bring them in.
Right. Can I ask about this proposed legislation in the Knesset to do with UNRWA, the main UN relief agency dealing with the Palestinians? I mean, UNRWA's sort of been in the Israeli government and Israeli politicians' sights for quite some time. This is we've heard on BBC from Sharon Haskell. She's a member of the Knesset with the New Hope Party and is proposing one of the bills aimed at stripping the rights of UNRWA to operate out of Israel and the occupied territories. This is what she had to say.
Our main problem is that UNRWA is an organization that was taken over by a terrorist organization. Its facility, which have also immunity and all the benefits that comes with an international United Nations organization, is being used against our people. People who actually worked for this organization massacred our people, our children.
Clearly, UNRWA would take issue with that characterization. I think they've said that they've discovered a handful of people who may have been involved in October the 7th, the massacre, and they have been sacked from the agency. But were this legislation to go through, what effect would it have?
I mean, first of all, we still don't know if this vote will take place as planned. It has support in the government and in parts of the opposition, but there's so much international pressure to try to stop this from happening. The legislation that has been drawn up basically stops UNRWA from being able to operate in Israel or in Israeli annexed East Jerusalem. It bans its activities. It prohibits contacts between Israeli officials and UNRWA. So that would mean, like, you know, loss of visas, loss of access for UNRWA staff coming from overseas. I mean, there is a historic opposition to the existence of UNRWA that you find in Israel because people argue that it perpetuates the hope of a so-called right of return for Palestinians to go back to their historic homes in land that's now part of the state of Israel. It's one of the unresolved core issues in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. But then more specifically, we have seen, you know, these accusations by Israel that UNRWA is complicit with Hamas, something that it denies. Israel's pointed out the involvement of some UNRWA employees in those 7th of October attacks, including a commander who was killed last week. UNRWA points out that it sacked 9 workers after finding they may have been involved in an attack that they did an internal investigation at the UN. I mean, the big impact would be in Gaza, where UNRWA is a major employer. It's also the main UN humanitarian agency that is operating on the ground at a time when already the UN is saying that not enough aid is getting in. The UN Secretary General has said it would be a catastrophe to ban UNRWA. It's also providing this vital role to historic, you know, Palestinian refugees, their descendants in the occupied West Bank. 44,000 yeah. school pupils rely on UNRWA there.
And that was Yolan Nel, our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem. Towards the end of the programme, I'll be hearing from the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert. Also coming up, we'll explore what's been called a silent exodus of French Africans quitting France to move to the continent their parents left.
In France, sometimes it feels like there's a glass ceiling. Within the leadership, the managers, you find very little diversity. Obviously, Africa feels more like open arms to me.
That report coming up in just over 10 minutes. Our headlines this hour from the BBC newsroom. The head of NATO says that the arrival of North Korean troops in Russia is a sign of Vladimir Putin's desperation in the war against Ukraine. And as we've been hearing, United Nations data show that greenhouse gases are accumulating in the atmosphere faster than at any time in human history. You were the BBC World Service and live from London, NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Within the next hour, tens of thousands are expected to gather in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, to protest against the results of the general election over the weekend. The governing Georgian Dream Party has been declared the winner. The party's critics decry it as pro-Russian and claim that the vote was rigged, claims which the Prime Minister, Irakli Kobak Idstu, has dismissed. And he's gained support today with a visit from his Hungarian counterpart, Viktor Orban, offering his congratulations in person. Alexandra Krivaus-Asatiani is the international spokesman for the United National Movement in Georgia. What difference will these protests make?
A huge difference, because what we see right now, the main priority is the legitimacy, or rather the lack of this sham that was an election. Here in Georgia, every major domestic actor has already said they are not recognizing the results as was posted by the Central Election Commission. So the next point of pressure must come from the international community. The international community must take a stand. And from our past experience, what we see is that the international community gets involved in Georgia and in protecting Georgian democracy only when they see a strong will by the Georgian people to defend their own rights. So that's what we're aiming for. We want to show the world that we're not going to back down. Yeah. We're already seeing some kind of careful statements coming from Brussels and Washington, and we're not okay with that.
Okay, I'll talk to you more about the international reaction in just a moment, but I want to pick you up on you saying every major actor has said that they're not happy with this election. I mean, that's not right, is it? Because obviously, domestically, you've got the governing party, which has said it's been fine, by and large. I mean, they've said, look, there have been irregularities, or at least allegations of irregularities in some precincts, but a tiny minority of precincts, and they will be investigated. So as far as the government is concerned, you're slinging a lot of mud, but it's yet to stick.
Yeah. Well, so obviously we were expecting the government that cheated this election to say that. Here's the facts on the ground. In every single precinct, every single, not most, not a couple, every single precinct in Georgia, voter secrecy was completely violated. But also, there were just our party filed upwards of 300 election lawsuits on election day. There's still a lot more that will come. We're talking about violence. We're talking about precincts where there were criminal gangs hovering around, intimidating people. We saw ballot stuffing.
It's been striking that although concern has been expressed by some international observers, I mean, like the OSCE, and I was looking at the statement from the British government just before I started this interview, there has been concern about just how free and fair the election process has been. They have not used the language that you have, though, talking about it, the election being cheated, it being fraudulent, it being stolen. They are definitely not saying that. I just wonder whether that actually means that, in a sense, your cause is starting at something of a disadvantage here.
Well, I would say no, because unlike under any other authoritarian regime, you wouldn't have the president of Georgia publicly saying that this was a Russian special operation and publicly saying that she would not recognize the results of
Yeah, but I'm talking about the international reaction here, because you said that you want international governments not to recognize, in quotes, this illegitimate government. It doesn't sound like they're preparing to do that.
No, well, I'm just getting to that. I'm just saying that we're not really at a disadvantage because of that. However, when it comes to the international community, what we're going to see is right now the international community is giving a chance to Georgian Dream to do the right thing, whether the right thing is investigation or doing a new election. That's, I don't know. That's for the international community to decide. But we'll see that Georgian Dream, out of experience, will not do any of those steps, and then the pressure will come.
Well, the pressure may come, but we saw earlier this year with the big protests against the foreign agents law that nothing changed.
I would disagree that nothing changed. The reason why the protest ended was not because we got tired. It's because we saw an opportunity to right now regroup and fight for the elections. Now, this is all hands down. If we lose this, Georgian democracy is over for a very long time. We know there's no coming back to this. I don't want to sound too dramatic about it, but this is really the ultimate battle, because what Georgian Dream has promised is just pure persecutions against opposition leaders. So we know that if we don't win now, if we don't defeat Georgian Dream now, we'll all end up in prison or worse.
And that was Alexandre Crevaux-Assatiani, international spokesman for the opposition United National Movement in Georgia. Now, the sweet sound of discovery. Foreboding dark-hued start of a Chopin waltz played by the pianist Lang Lang for the New York Times video clip. But extraordinarily, this appears to be a new Chopin waltz, which, given that the composer died in 1849, is quite something. But the curator of the library in the museum in New York, where the manuscript has just been discovered, is pretty much convinced that this is a work by one of the great Romantic composers, the first such discovery for more than 50 years. That curator is Robinson McClellan. How did he come across it?
It's funny because it was in the process of one of the more, I would say, quotidian parts of my job, cataloging new collections. The collection came to us a few years ago, and the process was a bit delayed by the pandemic. And so I wasn't expecting this, certainly. And when I saw the manuscript, I suppose my first reaction was one of cautious excitement, thinking this really could be something. I didn't recognize the music. I looked at various other Chopin waltzes thinking, oh, it must be one of the known waltzes and that I just haven't happened to have heard and could not find it. And so fairly quickly approached Jeffrey Kahlberg, one of the leading Chopin experts, and showed him the manuscript, and he was immediately excited, and then we went from there in the process of authenticating it.
Right. So you, I mean, and that process, I mean, it's not actually signed by Chopin, this
right,
manuscript.
Right.
But so you presumably did the sort of checks that made you think, actually, it doesn't just sound like Chopin, but it's, you know, pretty recognizably the work of Chopin.
Yes. So what we're most certain about actually is that it is written in the hand of Chopin, that it is paper that he wrote on himself in his own hand. What's not entirely sure is that it's music that he composed. I feel about 98% sure, and many people who've heard it already feel in their gut, you know, that this sounds like Chopin.
Yeah.
I mean, it does. There are possibilities.
And it is short, and it does it. I'm speaking in a totally inexpert way, but it sounds plausibly like Chopin. And I guess the tantalizing thing is that we know that he did write quite a few waltzes that have been lost to posterity, haven't they?
Indeed, and there are many stories of manuscripts that were seen decades or years ago that have been lost, and so there are many tantalizing stories like that. There are atypical aspects of the music. The kind of stormy opening is a little surprising, but not entirely out of character. And then the melody, really, to me, is where you feel that Chopin quality.
Robinson McClellan, curator of the Morgan Library and Museum in New York, who has discovered what may well be a new waltz by Chopin, Frédéric Chopin. You're listening to NewsHour.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Amid a backdrop of rising nationalism, police violence and social tensions in France, some young French people of African descent are turning to the continent in search of what they say is a better life. for BBC Africa Eye. We've got this exploration of what's called reverse migration, following their journeys to Senegal, journeys which are the opposite of those their parents made decades earlier. Noor Abidah has this report.
On a cold evening in Marseille, Menka arrives to the warmth of a large family celebration. Traditional meats and cheeses are served. This is a very French setting, but Menka's family, like many others, are part of the African diaspora with strong ties to Senegal. And that's where Menka is returning to. Tonight's gathering is Menka's last goodbye to family and France.
In France, sometimes it feels like there's a glass ceiling. Within the leadership, the managers, you find very little diversity. Africa feels more like open arms to me.
And he's not alone. He's part of what's being described as a silent exodus. Young French Senegalese nationals who've chosen to leave France behind. Against a background of rising nationalism, attitudes towards immigration are hardening in France. The anti-immigration national rally lost the 2024 legislative elections, but has emerged as the country's largest single party. In a recent survey in France, 91% of black people interviewed suggested they've been victims of racial discrimination. In June last year, riots erupted across the country following the fatal shooting by police of Nahel Merzouk, a 17-year-old French national of Moroccan and Algerian descent. The case is still being investigated, but the events shook the nation. They represented something much deeper that had been building for years. Anger over the way marginalized communities are perceived to have been treated in France. But there are those who don't see leaving France as the answer. Abdul and his sister Fatoumata grew up in Paris. Like Menka, Fatoumata is planning a move to West Africa to set up a software company, while Abdul feels very much at home in France.
I'm worried about her, but I don't feel the need to reconnect with anything. My culture and my family is here.
Menka lands in Senegal.
I was born in France. There's been a lot of racism. Now I feel like I am home. You feel like anything can happen here.
Menka arrives to his new neighborhood in Dakar. He knocks on the door of his extended family.
C'est Menka, le neveu de Fria.
Menka. Menka Maria.
Ça va?
He can't speak to them in their local language. He still feels an outsider. But this is something he hopes can change. Like some others making the journey, it's somewhere he feels connected to his heritage, but also a brighter future.
And that was Noor Abidah reporting. You can watch her full documentary from BBC Africa Eye. It's called The Homecoming on the BBC World Service YouTube page. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Ever since Donald Trump descended that escalator in Trump Tower back in 2015 to announce his apparently long-shot bid for the presidency, his opponents have been clutching their heads and yelling, "I can't believe he said that," or "That's it, he's done for, he'll hemorrhage support." And then he seems to defy normal political gravity, or at least old-school political wisdom. So the question today, 8 days out from the election, is whether the former president will be hurt by the latest yells of outrage, not over something he said, but something which was said on stage at a Trump rally in New York by the comedian Tony Hinchcliffe.
There's a lot going on. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
We can speak now to Jorge Martinez. He's from Puerto Rico. He's from San Juan there. He serves as a spokesperson at the conservative advocacy group America First Works and also a Hispanic outreach strategist. He's in Washington, D.C. Jorge, were you offended?
No, Tim, I wasn't offended, but we strongly condemn what was obviously the crude and offensive joke told by Tony Hinchcliffe at yesterday's rally at Madison Square Garden. The joke was inappropriate, it fell flat, and it does not reflect the heart, the soul, or the mind of Donald J. Trump, when it comes to his respect for the people of Puerto Rico.
Right. I mean, this was not just a one-off, though. I mean, this particular comedian who did get laughs at the rally. I mean, he also had a go at Jews, Palestinians, black people. And then you had the language from others aimed at the Democratic nominee, Kamala Harris, prostitute with pimp handlers, the devil. She was described as Samoan Malaysian by Tucker Carlson. I mean, you know, what Tony Hinchcliffe said may have caught the headlines, but it wasn't completely out of context at that rally, was it?
Well, it was out of context. And again, we need to remember that this is a comedian who's going to push the envelope and the boundaries of what people may consider an appropriate
joke. Well, the other people weren't comedians.
Right. Well, listen, the fact of the matter is that, you know, President Trump, number one, was the first U.S. sitting president to visit Puerto Rico in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Maria. He has consistently demonstrated his deep commitment to the island and its people, both in times of need and in efforts to rebuild for a better future.
There was a report by the Housing Department's Office of the Inspector General after Hurricane Maria saying that the Trump administration had delayed more than $20 billion in relief aid for the island.
Well, incorrect. The Trump administration swiftly approved almost $40 billion in federal aid to support recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction efforts across the island, especially after these hurricanes. Political mismanagement by Puerto Rico's leadership, actually under three governors that are affiliated with the Democratic Party, caused delays in distributing these essential funds. And what has happened is that this neglect by the Biden-Harris administration and lack of accountability has allowed these issues to fester, and it has left the people of Puerto Rico with an unreliable power grid that is prone to outages and threatens public safety, crippling economic stagnation, and no clear strategy for sustainable development, and dilapidated schools that have failed the children of Puerto Rico and with many left behind.
Yeah. I just to drag it back to, I guess, the story of the day and these comments, which I know you said you're disowning because they were made by a comedian. I guess the question, though, is whether, you know, you can be so confident that those very important Hispanic voters in very important swing states who, you know, most people have probably made up their minds, but there will be some who will be thinking to themselves, can I actually really bring myself to vote for Donald Trump? And if he is surrounding himself with these sorts of people who feel that they can join the Trump train, are they people that I want to have as fellow passengers?
Well, Tim, obviously these people do not speak for President Trump. And here's the answer to this simple question. You know, who is the president that is going to allow you to keep more of what you have and give you more of what you need? Hispanics across the United States.
But also maybe feel that they don't belong.
Well, they do belong. And it's very simple. When you compare the period of time of the Trump administration before the pandemic and the 4 years of the Biden-Harris administration. So the comparison is one of the best economic times in history for the Hispanic population, more Hispanics opening businesses and getting sustainable jobs and safety and secure neighborhoods versus the highest inflation in 40 years, the price of goods going 20%, gas 50%, more and more Hispanics living month to month. People are fed up. They're saying basta ya, which means no more. And they're rejecting the politics of the left and embracing the America First agenda of Donald Trump.
Jorge Martinez, thank you very much for joining us. A prolific Vietnamese people smuggler has shared details of the forgery, fraud and deceit used to enable migrants heading for the United Kingdom to gain European visas, opening a pathway to crossing the channel in small boats. More than 2,200 Vietnamese have crossed this relatively narrow stretch of sea between England and France so far this year, the single highest national group in small boat arrivals. It's also been the deadliest year on record for those attempting the crossing, with more than 50 killed in the water between northern France and England. The BBC's Andrew Harding spoke to the smuggler as part of an extensive investigation into why so many Vietnamese people are choosing such a dangerous route into Great Britain.
We're heading down a muddy path in an area where there are, we know, hundreds of migrants camping out in the woods, in the forests. It's clear, bright day, but it's been raining heavily. Little camps you can see all over, mostly in the undergrowth. Okay, it's very quiet now. Dozens of these tiny little one or two men, igloo-style tents. Three shopping trolleys lying empty there. Clothes hanging on lines from the trees. Hello? Hello?
Hello, sir.
There's a man in a big tent here that he's hung up from a tree trunk, and he's just putting his shoes on to come out and see us. Do you speak some English?
Yeah.
No. The man is from Vietnam, a country that's emerged quite suddenly this year as the largest single source of people heading to Britain in small boats. Are you aware that what you're trying to do here, this crossing to the UK, is incredibly dangerous and illegal?
Yes, I'm aware.
And that doesn't stop you?
No.
Why not?
I have no other choice. If I return to Vietnam, I have nothing there. I already sold my house, but it wasn't enough to pay off my debt. I still owe £50,000.
As we move around the woods, several Vietnamese mention that the smugglers may be nearby. A lot of the gangs are armed. Violence is not uncommon. Is it dangerous to talk about that sort of thing?
I don't think he's comfortable with us.
No, we'll leave you alone. We don't want to endanger you. We've managed to make contact by phone with one of the Vietnamese smugglers, but it turns out he's already in the UK, so I'm driving now to an undisclosed location somewhere in northern England to meet him in person. A translator is going to be speaking his words.
It's a very lucrative business. If you have a good reputation, the clients come to you. No force, no violence.
We'll call him Tan, a slim, neatly dressed man who crossed the channel in a small boat earlier this year. He spent most of his adult life in the smuggling business. We're keeping his identity confidential, the only way he'd agree to tell us about his work. He's now applying for asylum in the UK. You told the British authorities you'd been trafficked here, but that's not true, is it?
No, I was not trafficked here. I said I was, because that's just the way it's done. It's what you say in order to get asylum.
The police and human rights groups say that's nonsense, that many Vietnamese brought to the UK are victims of modern slavery. For some years, Tan worked for a smuggling gang in France, but he then went back to Vietnam, where he began forging documents for people trying to get visas to Europe.
I'm good at this work. People trust me. I never fail.
He's showing me here some of the documents that he's actually forged. He's got copies on his phone. One is for a bank statement. Another is for some pay slips. And this is a Hungarian visa, a genuine visa that one of his customers was given on the basis of his forged documents. How do you justify what you do here? You've come to the UK illegally. You're still breaking the law by assisting other people to come here illegally. At the same time, you're taking British taxpayers' money to be fed, to be sheltered here in the UK.
I just do paperwork. I help people to travel. I don't force them to take certain routes.
I think a lot of British people watching this will not buy that. They will say that you are a criminal and that you should hand yourself into the police.
The way I see it, I don't do anything illegal here in the UK. I'm not breaking the law here. I was only breaking Vietnamese law.
How long have we been in touch with this man?
10 days ago.
But back in France, the smuggling continues. To understand more about the shadowy Vietnamese operation there, we decide to go undercover. My colleague here, he has been posing as a Vietnamese migrant, and you've made contact with this smuggler, yeah?
Yeah, I did over the last 10 days or so.
And he thinks you're a migrant from Vietnam who's come through Europe, and you're now waiting to get on a small boat.
Yeah, sure. That's what I tried to convince him.
You say you found out about this smuggler online. Tell me a bit about that process.
It's quite open business. They advertise this quite frankly and openly on Facebook. They don't feel fear about that, and even they don't think that it's kind of the criminal at all.
And he's saying what?
He expects me to come to this area and then get in touch with him.
So you're going to have a face-to-face meeting, yeah?
I hope that I could see him sometime this afternoon.
Okay.
Bonjour. BBC.
Our team waits near a spot where other migrants gather for humanitarian aid. Our colleague, still posing as a migrant, calls the smuggler.
Em ơi, em đang đi đến đâu rồi?
He tells her to move away towards the woods through a broken fence. It's dangerous. And our colleague suddenly signals that she's not okay.
She wants to be rescued.
Okay, she wants out.
Come back, come back.
Okay. Don't catch up with the guy, the blonde guy.
We get a glimpse of the smuggler, a tall figure now vanishing back into the woods. Our colleague is safe, but in similar circumstances, many others are not. Some forced, others willingly embarking on an increasingly dangerous voyage.
And that was the BBC's Andrew Harding with that investigation. You're listening to NewsHour. This is the BBC World Service and live from London, NewsHour, with me, Tim Franks. And we're heading back to the Middle East now. We heard earlier on the programme about the latest hesitant attempts to negotiate a ceasefire. But what about longer term, about trying to end not just this conflict, but the conflict, the century-old fight between Israelis and Palestinians over this small patch of land? It might seem absurd even to talk about such a thing right now, but that's what all of Israel's allies insist will need to be confronted as soon as this latest terrible spasm is over. And it's what the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, once seen as a strong man of the right, is also saying, along with the former Palestinian Foreign Minister Nasser al-Kidwa. Together they've drawn up a plan to revive the two-state process. So the question for Mr. Olmert when he came into the NewsHour studio today was how to get from where we are now to where he wants us to be.
We have to train the governments in both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. And in each one of the places, it's not easy. But it will have to be done. I think that when we will come to the end of this immediate conflict that we are now involved with, both in Gaza and in the north, and it will not last forever, then we will have to come to terms with ourselves. In other words, we'll have to ask ourselves, okay, where are we going? How can we seriously prevent a repetition of these terrible events that we have been through, both in the south and in the north, in the near future or in the distant future? And there is no other political solution than a two-state solution. So it will come as part of a more radical change in Israeli politics. Netanyahu will be forced out. I have no doubt about that. The new government, unwilling as it may appear to be at the present time, when they are in the opposition, to subscribe to these ideas that we have outlined, they will have to.
But you will be aware that there are a lot of people who say the definition of insanity is to try to carry on doing something which is bearing absolutely no fruit, which has no signs of success. And the two-state solution, I mean, people have been talking about it for decades. We're further away than ever.
Had someone told you at the beginning of 2005 that within a year, Arik Sharon will dismantle all of the settlements that he built in the Gaza, settlements that he built, and that he will dismantle them, you would have said that this is crazy. And it happened.
Yeah.
I had the privilege of being part of this.
Understood, but you'll also know that there are a lot of people in Israel who say, well, that's exhibit A in terms of it does not work. The one of the original sins was to leave Gaza. Look what happened. Hamas took over in 2007, and we are where we are. And that's, I guess that's the point, is that it's not...
This is a short-sighted, limited attempt to excuse oneself of the major failures of understanding and comprehending the complexities of the Middle East. what happened.
But it's centrist Israeli suicide. Right now,
for a while, this is the mood, because we are in the middle of the war. We are still very close to the terrible tortures, you know, unbelievable, brutal events that took place on the 7th of October. But as we move away from that, and as we regained the confidence of our ability to defend ourselves, and what happened in the last couple of months, particularly the last few weeks, both in Lebanon and in Iran, has helped strengthen again the confidence of Israel that we can defend ourselves. Now, look, what happened on the 7th of October? We were sleeping out of arrogance, out of complacency. And we say to ourselves, okay, we know all the intelligence, we have all the knowledge about the plans or the Hamas and so on and so forth. Who are they? They are a bunch of nobodies. They will never be able to do what they did. And on the crucial day, there was no Israeli army, no Israeli defense, no one in the border. And they could just break through and enter into the Israeli settlements and kill and butcher and rape and behead people. And this was terrible. That is not a paradigm for how Israel should handle itself and how strong we can be in defending ourselves. And therefore, I don't think that it can last forever. That we'll be scared to death because of 3,000 or 5,000 terrorists. And therefore, I think that there is a very good background upon which we can build the campaign that needs to change the public opinion of the state of Israel. Because at the end of the day, okay, you know, when you come to people and you say to them, okay, we destroy Hamas, there is no Hamas left, they are all killed, we destroy Hezbollah, but there are still 6 million Palestinians. What are we going to do with them? Are we going to be occupied forever, deny them of the right for self-determination? Are we going to stop them from free movement in the territories and whatnot? And this is crazy. If we do that, we determine that we will forever continue our fightings and our killings and the bloodshed and the terrible human cost, which is part of this. I think that there is a very good basis to build up this effort, this campaign, and the change of the opinion. And I'm very optimistic.
You're optimistic?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because this would be optimistic 25 years ago. Perhaps it's fantasy now.
It was optimistic 25 years ago, and I think that after the pain and the suffering that all of us will have been through, Palestinians as well as us, and I do not underestimate the terrible suffering of the Palestinians in what happened. Okay? On the first day, many of them were absolutely crazy of joy that they have succeeded to surprise us and to do what they did. But then the suffering of the Palestinians, the hundreds of thousands of them, the destruction of Gaza and all of this, perhaps may have told them something about the cost of war and the cost of continuing this conflict. And the same with us. So I entirely disagree with about the description of a fantasy. It's difficult. It's hard. It will require a different type of leadership in both places. That is what I started with. We need a different leadership, a leadership that has the courage to say the unpopular at a certain time, for the ability to change the tide in the public opinion. And we will have this leadership. There is no question about it. Now, don't ask me who. I don't know yet, but we will have it.
And that was the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert speaking to me in the NewsHour studio a little earlier on today. That's it from this edition of the programme. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.